This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As our communities continue working to get more people a vaccine against COVID-19, vaccination has also recently begun for other species. Zoo animals are now being inoculated using a specialized vaccine at Brookfield Zoo outside Chicago. One of the people behind the effort is Dr. Michael Adkisson, Vice President of Clinical Medicine for the Chicago Zoological Society, which operates Brookfield Zoo, and he joins us now. Dr. Adkisson, welcome to The 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, because we're taping this conversation in advance, we're not taking phone calls for this segment, but we always do love hearing what you thought about what we talked about on the show. You can contact us by sending us an email at talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. All right, so Dr. Adkisson, let's start with the vaccine. How is this different from the one being administered to humans?
Now, this vaccine was developed by Zoetis, which is an animal health company with a long history of vaccine development. And relatively early on in the pandemic, there were some species that have been affected with COVID, and vaccine development began pretty early on in the whole pandemic with the thought that there may be a potential need for it in different animal species.
And maybe we can talk about that. What is the threat of COVID-19 in animals that we know of?
It's a great question, and one that scientists and researchers are still working to fully unlock. We know that there are other species that have been impacted. There have been numerous reports around the United States as well as around the world of different zoo animals becoming infected and also showing clinical signs of illness. A number of zoos have seen problems in lions and tigers and some of the other cat species, as well as gorillas, other primates, and also some other kind of unrelated species in mink and small carnivore species.
And I think most of our listeners are probably pretty familiar with symptoms of COVID-19 that humans experience. How does it manifest in an animal that contracts the virus?
It's quite similar. The animals that have been clinically ill from it have been presenting with many of the same signs we see in people in terms of upper respiratory infection, congestion of the sinuses, coughing. They, you know, look like they don't feel well. They're tired, lethargic, appetites off, those types of things. So it's really a pretty similar disease process for the animals that do seem to be susceptible to it.
And do we know what the sort of morbidity and mortality is? Are there documented cases of animals dying from COVID?
That's a difficult question to answer. Very early on in the pandemic, many, many zoos took pretty significant steps to try and eliminate any risk of it potentially spreading to their animals even before we knew for sure that that was possible. So for instance, here at Brookfield Zoo, we've had our staff in masks anytime they were around the animals up close. We've increased personal protective equipment. We've been trying to increase social distancing between care staff and the animals where it made sense. And it's really in many ways not any different than how we work with a lot of our different animals on a daily basis. Our gorillas, our orangutans, many of our primates are susceptible to the same cold viruses that people carry. And so in many cases, we've been doing a lot of these protective measures for years already. We just needed to tighten it up even tighter with the threat of COVID. So it's a little hard to know how badly it really would be if those mechanisms weren't in place and if animals were exposed to it routinely, what the morbidity and mortality might look like.
What are the reasons beyond sort of animal welfare for vaccinating animals in a zoo, right? Does it also potentially affect human health?
It does. We see it, you know, animals and people are interconnected in a variety of different ways when it comes to diseases and health. So this is as much about keeping our animals healthy as it is about keeping our staff and our guests safe. We want to make sure that we don't have a situation where an animal that is infected may potentially be able to spread it back to humans. So we're taking very good precautions to make sure that's the case.
You know, there are viruses that, like I'm thinking HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, and FIV, feline immunodeficiency mm-hmm. virus. They're similar. They're different, species specific. Do we know to what extent COVID is similar or different among humans and other animals?
It's an excellent question. So COVID-19, the virus behind the pandemic, is a coronavirus. And there are many, many, many different coronaviruses out there that infect different species. They range in the disease states that they cause, from very mild cold and flu-like symptoms to very serious diseases in some other species. So we know that these viruses are able to jump between species. A lot of the thought behind where COVID came from is that it came out of a wildlife reservoir. And as people continue to expand our communities and our footprint on the globe, they're in closer and closer contact with animals in many of those locations. And as we continue to push ourselves into animal habitats, we increase that risk of viruses being able to jump from wildlife to people.
Listeners, if you're just joining in, we're speaking with Dr. Michael Adkisson. He's Vice President of Clinical Medicine for the Chicago Zoological Society, which manages Brookfield Zoo. He's a specialist in zoo and wildlife medicine. We'd love to hear what you thought about our conversation. We're taping this ahead of time, so we're not taking calls. But if you want to contact us, you can always tweet to us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. So, Dr. Adkisson, when the vaccine for people was rolled out, it was typically administered first to those at highest risk, right? Healthcare workers were first up, then people with underlying conditions and comorbidities, certain age demographics. Are there certain priority tiers for, you know, in the sort of zoological kingdom?
Absolutely. We've approached it in very much the same mentality as the rollout of the vaccine within the human population. We have taken the species where there have been documented illness in other zoos in terms of big cats, primates, small carnivores, and those were the animals that we started with first. And as we've worked our way through that set of animals, we've moved on to ones where we feel there's a theoretical risk of them being able to contract the virus and potentially become ill from it. And we've prioritized our animal groups on down to those that we feel are the lowest risk and not likely to be affected by it.
You know, in humans, there's been a lot of attention to people who have comorbidities being more susceptible, right? Be it diabetes, yes, or obesity. Are there obese animals in zoos or, you know, diabetic animals? Is that something that's a concern as well?
There are. We deal with many of the same states of health that are dealt with on the human side. We spend a lot of our time these days taking care of our animals from a geriatric standpoint. As medical care in a veterinary setting has continued to advance, we're seeing animals that live longer and longer under human care. And with that longer life under human care, it provides the opportunity for them to develop many of the same degenerative diseases that we develop in terms of arthritis in their joints, the beginning of kidney failure, the beginning of heart failure. Those types of states are a common thing for us to treat and take care of to keep animals healthy. But those definitely do put animals at an increased risk from a comorbidity standpoint. So for our geriatric animals, for those animals with underlying health conditions, we've certainly taken that into consideration as we've prioritized where to go first with the vaccine.
I'm curious also about the process for actually carrying out these vaccinations. I got to imagine that a lion might resist more than my five-year-old typically does for immunizations. How does that work?
It's a great question. There's a wide variety of ways that we've been administering this vaccine. We've tried really hard to get as many animals habituated to the process as we possibly can. Our care staff maintains a wonderful relationship with the animals that they work with on a daily basis. And those are very trusting relationships. So in many cases, our animals are trained to voluntarily present a shoulder or a hip against a protective barrier where our staff is able to just directly administer the vaccine the same way that you or I would go in and roll up our shirt. In some cases, that's an easier process than it is for a five-year-old person. For other animals, it can be a little bit trickier. We've got small animals that we're able to just sort of pick up and hold while we administer the vaccine. For some of our larger animals, we do have to work a little bit harder to get the vaccine into them.
Is there, I mean, I'm just sort of spitballing here. Is there a, you know, ever like an injection dart, you know, fired from a distance, or is that just not a really sound medical way of proceeding?
No, that is something that we do work with. We work with blow darts for some of our animals for administration of medication, for anesthetic agents if we need to put them under anesthesia for an exam, or sometimes for routine care like this vaccine. So that is a very realistic thing that does happen in terms of darting a vaccine.
You know, we've talked a lot on our program about vaccine hesitancy among our species. Is there such a thing as vaccine or medication hesitancy among animals that would be found in a zoo? Are some more willing than others and some pretty resistant? How does that look?
It really depends on the species. A lot of our animals are very comfortable and very cooperative. They have very strong trusting relationships with our staff, very similar to a dog or a cat that's a pet that, you know, trusts their caretaker and has confidence in, you know, what's going on at a given point in time. So that's the ideal that we always strive for, is for the animals to be able to sort of participate in their own healthcare, where it's a voluntary decision on the animal's part that they want to be within in reach of having a vaccine administered to them. For some of our animals, they are a little bit more cautious. Many animals have evolved over time to, you know, take a more reclusive approach to life or to maintain a greater distance from people. And in those animals, it can be a little bit more difficult for us to teach that behavior. But we work really hard to make sure that we're administering those vaccines in as stress-free of an environment as we possibly can.
You know, we've talked about some of the species that you're focusing on here. Is it just mammalian species? Are there other, I don't know, marsupials, maybe even, I don't know, reptiles? Does it, you know, where are the limits of this?
Yeah, so right now the prevailing wisdom is that this is purely a mammalian virus, and that this is not something that we need to worry about within our birds or our reptiles or anything like that. So our approach has been focused strictly on the mammals within the zoo. It's over 300 that we've been identifying that we will be putting the vaccine into from a protective standpoint. The vaccine it's still an investigational vaccine, but it has been fully approved by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as well as the Illinois State Veterinarian. So this is not a experimental vaccine or anything like that. This is a fully approved vaccine. It's something that we feel very confident in the safety of. So we don't have concerns with the number of animals that we're administering it to. It's been well tested in a number of different domestic animal models. So we know that it's a safe vaccine for us to give to our animals.
And, you know, I'm just so fascinated. Thank you for bearing with my questions about the process here of sort of behind the scenes at the zoo. What about quantity? Is this something where I know we're seeing that with the human vaccines, they're talking about maybe a different dosing amount for children. I got to imagine, you know, working on a bear or a lion versus, you know, a mouse or something smaller like that, that maybe there's a different quantity involved?
It's a good question. When we think about vaccines, really we're thinking about the vaccine as just a way of sort of priming the immune system. So we're introducing a foreign entity to the body, allowing the body to recognize that, react to it, and get the immune system prepped if it needs to do anything, if should encounter that virus again. For this vaccine, very similar to the human vaccine, it's two doses, 3 weeks apart. That really gives the immune system within the body time to process it. And then that second vaccine is really a booster that sets the body up in a state that if it should encounter the virus down the road, it's got a very robust response that it's able to mount very quickly. A lot of times vaccines are just dosed purely by the amount of antigenic load or the amount of virus that's within the vaccine. So in that context, the same dose can be used for a very small animal and a very large animal. There's definitely differences in how that's fine-tuned for people. So as we look at the vaccine being approved in humans for pediatric applications, we do see a decrease in the load of virus that's being given. But that's a subtle change. That's really there to try and best minimize side effects from the vaccine. And when we think about our animals, most of our animals get the same dose of vaccine, very similar to vaccines that we would give our pet dogs, a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, at two very opposite ends of the spectrum there, receive the same vaccine dose.
Speaking of dogs and cats, a lot of our listeners, I imagine, have animal companions in their households. Do you have any idea of whether the vaccine might be available or recommended for pets at some point?
It's a wonderful question. So right now, the science has shown that dogs and cats are not playing a significant role in transmission of the virus or acting as a reservoir or allowing it to spread from dog to human or cat to human. So right now, the prevailing wisdom is that there is no necessary vaccine for companion animals. As continued variants of COVID continue to emerge and we look at some of the new variants that are coming into play, those recommendations may change over time. But right now, for those listeners that have a pet dog or cat at home, not something that they need to worry about, not something that they need to worry about addressing a vaccine with their veterinarian.
The last thing I want to ask you about, as a veterinarian, I'm curious if you have any ideas or what your assessment is of some of the competing hypotheses for the origins of COVID-19, right? Bats, possibly pangolins acting as an intermediate species. What is your perspective on that?
It's a difficult question to answer. And there's still, I think, a lot of science and research that is still ongoing that will hopefully provide us a more definitive answer on that as time goes on. I think the scientific community has really come to a very strong consensus that it is a naturally occurring virus, that it is not something that was man-made or created with a hostile intent behind it or anything like that. Where it came from, though, when we talk about species that it may have jumped out of, that's a very difficult thing to unlock. I'm hopeful that we will get there eventually from a scientific standpoint, but I don't think it's there yet. This virus is very similar to the SARS virus that was an outbreak. And in that case, there was definitely some intermediate host species identified. And I think the prevailing wisdom is that this is probably a fairly similar situation, whereas humans have come into greater contact with wildlife species, we're seeing more and more emerging diseases come out of those settings.
Dr. Michael Adkisson is Vice President of Clinical Medicine for the Chicago Zoological Society, which operates Brookfield Zoo. Dr. Adkisson, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to the 21st. Stay with us.